If you look at a wet lab as a data production environment rather than a biological environment only, yeah, the way the life sciences and the laboratories in the life sciences create and share and disseminate data is broken. And increasingly in the world we operate in vis-a-vis drug discovery, that information is critical.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Today, we're joined by Mustafa El Sayed, co-founder and CEO of Automata, a company that's revolutionizing the way scientists work in labs by providing a full-stack solution for lab automation. Automata's platform Link integrates scientific instruments on a space-saving, robot-enabled lab bench, allowing them to design, schedule, and manage workflows remotely via cloud-based software. With a background in architecture and a passion for design and technology, Mustafa has a unique perspective on how automation can address the inefficiencies and data management issues that absolutely plague life sciences labs. Hosting the conversation, Yin He, Principal Business Development for Healthcare and Life Sciences Startups at AWS, will speak with Mustafa about his vision for the future of lab automation, the challenges of building a full-stack solution, and how Automata is helping its customers accelerate drug discovery research. Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm excited to guest host a session today. My name is Yin He, and I lead our work with early-stage healthcare and life sciences startups and investors at AWS. I'm trained as a wet lab scientist. I have a PhD in molecular bio and genomics. And prior to AWS, I was an early employee and operator at a venture-backed startup building cloud labs and software tools to help pharma and biotech accelerate drug discovery. I'm so thrilled to be joined today by Mustafa El Sayed, CEO and co-founder of Automata. As a previous operator in this space, connected lab, lab in the loop, I feel like the terminology changes every couple of years. I'm super excited to get Mustafa's insider view of the new advances that are happening and what the state of the art looks like now in the industry. So let's dig in. I'm really excited to learn more about your founder journey and how Automata came to be.
Amazing. Thanks, Inhi. Glad to be here.
All right. First, just tell us a little bit about Automata, what you all do, and how is this approach differentiated and unique in the market?
Sure. So Automata is a lab automation startup. We're based here in London, but we have offices in the US, in Boston, and on the West Coast. And how we got here is a bit of a long story, but the short version of it is Automata was born in 2016 as a general automation company. And over time, we had sold and developed robotics primarily. And over time, we really just saw something super interesting happening in the life sciences. And 2019, we went all in on lab automation. And we've basically been operating as a lab automation provider since 2020. And yeah, we're really excited about what's happening in the life sciences at the moment. There's a massive amount of interest in the automation of the wet lab. And we're seeing a set of tailwinds and headwinds on the laboratory that are causing folks to really consider automating their laboratory. So to go through those briefly, I think the headwinds are primarily economic. I'm sure it won't come as a surprise to you that companies that have wet labs at their heart currently struggle to find staff to operate those wet labs. Increasingly in core geographies like here in the UK and Oxford and Cambridge, in the US places like Boston and San Francisco and San Diego, there's increasingly a shortage of ready to go wet lab space. And we've seen wet labs being built in some pretty surprising situations. And finally, in the midst of all of that, the throughput requirements on the lab, the accuracy requirements on the lab are only going up and up. So those are the headwinds facing these organizations who have wet labs. But in the same time, there's a really exciting set of tailwinds that are causing folks to automate, namely the kind of amazing technology that's now available to companies in their laboratory from the ELN downwards. Mm-hmm. And as well, the kind of surge of interest in machine learning and artificial intelligence in the laboratory that is making folks really explore the entirety of their stack and double down on those investments to be ML AI ready. So that's what we're seeing in the lab automation space at the moment.
Got it. Typically, we'd go into your background, but I just want to double click on something you said in terms of the business model. You really seem to embrace, right, being a lab automation company. There's automation, there's software, there's services, lots of different business models in this space. Tell me a little bit more, like how you think through that and why the focus on automation.
Yeah, we've thought a lot about that as we built Automata as a lab automation company. And we came to a pretty simple conclusion that the main thing that matters here is the customer's success with automation, right? You could build the best tools in the market. You can have the best teams in the space. You can work with the most capable customer, the biggest customers, the smallest customers. At the end of the day, what matters is the customer succeeds. I'm sure you're familiar with this, Yini, that the typical saying with operators who've tried to build automation and operators who've tried to utilize automation is that automation is a graveyard of good intention. Right? Yeah. Like how many times have you walked into a lab, or in my background, walked into a factory and just seen robotics sitting there? And the conclusion Automata came to is this distinction of, am I hardware, software, services, gets in the way of customer success. Realistically, the customer needs all of the above at the current state of the customer's readiness and the technology available for automation to truly meet their requirements. And that is what drove us as a startup, that being full stack is the only way to deploying automation at scale successfully in laboratories. And therefore, we found a business model that makes that work for us at a margin profile that allows us to scale at an incredibly aggressive growth rate. And being driven as a company where every single work cell we put out in the field works. And that requires hardware, which allows you to build incredible software, but supported by an incredible service organization that can make those two things successful as well.
Yeah, we hear this a lot. It's like really thinking about in a lab, what does that full stack solution look like? It's not one or the other. All of these are all related, right, to each other. And they're all in different various components, right, needed in order to be successful. And I really like abstracting away this foundational technology, right? At the end of the day, we're in this to make science, right, better, faster, more efficient, right? And if you take a couple more steps up, right? It's about improving human health and access to care and drugs and all.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes we tend to focus right on the foundational technology, but it's really important to think about, okay, if you abstract all of that away, what is it ultimately that we're trying to do? I want to loop to your founder background. You alluded to it a little bit. It's more non-traditional, non-canonical, which we always love to learn about. So tell us a little bit about that and how that led you to Automata.
Yeah, like usually what I'm saying at this point is, yeah, I don't have a background in the life sciences. I don't have a background in robotics and I don't have a background in engineering. So feel free to take the next 20 or 30 minutes with a grain of salt. So I was trained as an architect in the traditional sense of that word, building buildings, and studied here in London in an incredible course called the Design Research Lab, which really focused at the intersection of design and technology. I went on to work in an incredible office here in London as well called Zaha Hadid Architecture or Architects. Some of your listeners might be familiar with it. For those in the US side of the house, think like Frank Gehry. And we worked in a very small team there focused on technology, right? So the easiest way to describe this is I wrote more algorithms for my day job than I designed the building. And that was essentially the start of our career as architects, where we wrote software, wrote code to solve problems for designers who are highly visual, creative creatures who don't like a lot of information. But a building is a big piece of information. And over time, we also got interested in, okay, we're getting really good at designing buildings digitally and designing buildings using computational logic. Can we close the loop and also build them in advanced fabrication methods? And this is going to tie back to how we think in Automata, ironically. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started getting fascinated with things like 3D printing and robotics. And these days you can learn anything on things like YouTube and Coursera. And that's what we did. You just dive into what is linear regression? How do I 3D print? And yeah, we started to use robots and it was just fundamentally annoying in a way where you're operating this $100,000 device that can kill you, that is silent and can carry like 100 kilos. And you program it on something that looks like an old school Casio calculator. And it just felt wrong. And my co-founder was like, hey, I'm going to build a robot at night. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. But he actually started doing that. And I ended up working with him after hours, after work, writing the software for that robot. And in 2015, 2016, we just like really enjoyed working on that project more than we did our day jobs. And that was essentially how Automata was born.
Wow, that's incredible. Now I see the ties, because later on, stay tuned, we're going to talk more about sort of the importance of design, UI, UX, right? And tools that we build for scientists in that community. But did you say Zaha Hadid?
Yes.
That's incredible. Okay, so in New York, she has this stunning building right on the High Line. Yeah, mm-hmm. If you walk by that building, it's, and I think what she's known for is like very futuristic, like these very curved, right, buildings. Yeah, it's stunning. Okay, very cool. So I think you talked about this a little bit, but I want to go back. And what do you see are the top three challenges in the industry? Not necessarily automation, but if we think about ultimately this is being built for labs, right, and drug discovery and pharma and biotechs. What do you think are the top three challenges we see in that space right now? And then how does Automata's technology fit into that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So obviously, this is from the perspective of a lab automation company. Mm-hmm. And what we see, we're fairly low down the kind of discovery stack as a company. What we see are, I would say, two or three major challenges that center around the wet lab is an incredibly inefficient operating environment, right? You have some of the smartest people in the world working on pretty menial tasks. And apart from that kind of wasted human capital, it's also incredibly unstructured, right? You're lucky if you have some liquid handling in there, which kind of standardizes some processes. But in general, we've walked into tons of labs where people are still logging things on paper and pencil. Mm-hmm. And it's just impossible to retrieve that meaningfully. There's a lot of error. There's a lot of waste. There's a lot of do-over. So it's just
there's a lot of unknowns, right? That's what's
unknowns,
right? It's yeah. People don't log it. It didn't happen, right? Or I don't know how many times I just wrote a note to myself on a sticky pad, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Went to get lunch instead of an hour incubation. Yes. I think it was like an hour, 15 minutes.
This is a slight exaggeration, but not too much of an exaggeration. We start all of our projects with customers giving us their SOPs.
Yeah.
And one of our engineers, I remember him saying this to me 2 years ago, Jesus Christ, these things are like my grandmother's pizza recipe, right? And because if you ask her, like, why this step? And she's like, I don't know, I've always done it this way. And it's like, I did it at 5 p.m. on a Wednesday with the window open. So that's how I always do it, right?
But even worse, like, what is the actual compliance, right? Like, of the person who even wrote it, right? There's just variances that's happening, like, on a per-experiment basis, not to mention across lab members, right? And across labs.
Exactly. So that's definitely one challenge. I call it inefficiency and opaqueness. And then the second one is I thought my mom's a doctor. So my impression of the life sciences and medicine and things like this was these industries are biology in, biology out, right? And you come into it and you're like, oh, it's not that. It's biology in, information out, right? In the vast majority of cases. And if you look at a wet lab as a data production environment rather than a biological environment only, the way the life sciences and the laboratories in the life sciences create and share and disseminate data is broken. And increasingly in the world we operate in vis-a-vis drug discovery, that information is critical. And therefore we hear tons of stories where someone's querying a piece of data and they're like, I don't know what this is. Was this a DNA sample? What was this? And I heard a great phrase from someone in a biotech recently. It's like the computationalists will go back to the experimentalists and be like, hey, what is this? And they're like, oh, let me dig up that email from July 2022 where it's in there somewhere. Or let me send you that Excel sheet and they send you the wrong saved version of these kind of stories.
Yeah.
So that's another big problem holding us back at the moment. And I think all that manifests in drug discovery is a lot less collaborative, a lot less efficient, and in the end of the day, a lot less speedy than it can be. Mm-hmm. And I think that last one is the one we all care about in terms of getting therapies out in the world. So those are the kind of challenges we see in the space.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting because, like, I asked this to a lot of folks. A lot of companies are in AI-driven drug discovery. We hear the same challenges over and over, but it's interesting from the perspective of the startup, right? Like how they get phrased and printed right onto the industry. Okay, let's take a look at the other side of the coin. Imagine Automata is wildly successful, right? And other companies in the space. If you could travel, you know, time travel 15 years, right, into the future, what does drug discovery look like? Like, how has the market changed? How has the process changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Don't know about 15 years, but let's say 10 years down the line. And if Automata, and like you say, a cohort of other technologies succeed, because not much changes if we succeed alone, which is both intimidating and exciting. But let's say this kind of emergent technology stack, some people refer to it as tech bio these days, really succeeds. And I think that transforms industries like drug discovery and synthetic biology. And I think what fundamentally changes at the highest level is what we were talking about, the kind of amount of expenditure, the cost and time to develop a drug or a material significantly comes down. And I think the way we get there is how we leverage in silico versus in vitro radically shifts from where we are today. Or to simplify that, what we do in the lab and what we do computationally, that balance radically shifts, right? Like, this is just a guess. If I had to guess today, in the majority of drug discovery organizations, you're leveraging a lot more of what you do in the laboratory and biologically than you do what you, than what you do computationally. And the future we see 5-10 years from now is like, you should be able to run a million in silico loops for every single in vitro loop, right? And increasingly in vitro becomes a function of validation rather than a function of discovery. You're doing a lot of your discovery in silico, and that means your simulation tools, your workflow tools, all of that becomes incredibly more robust. And there's a burden on the models we use, and there's incredible companies to try to make that happen. That's not us. But also all the tooling downstream from those models, providing information to those models, allowing access for scientists to those models, because I think human ingenuity will always be part of this, that suddenly you have a world in which you just can race ahead computationally and also race ahead biologically. And that just brings those two metrics of efficiency and speed where they need to be. And I think more specifically in the field we operate in of lab automation, I think we move away from workflow-centric laboratories. What I mean by that is this idea that this lab does this work, even if it was fully automated with automata or other technologies like it today. What does this lab do? Oh, this is a functional genomics lab. What does this lab do? Oh, it's a cell culture lab. We move incrementally towards a capability-first work, right? And I think, Yunhee, that's where us and Stratius and these kind of visions overlapped, where ultimately where this all ends up is this idea of a black box. It's like a data center. You push in and pull out data.
Yeah, I love that idea. Ultimately, the future, it's not about, hey, we want to run a PCR, or we want to run the sequencing run, right? It's, hey, we want to find molecules that have these properties, right?
Exactly.
In terms of, you know, toxicity and efficacy and things like that. So how do we, you know, continue that abstraction layer, right? So then I think it really moves the skill set, right, from these highly trained, highly educated folks to doing a bunch of menial tasks that aren't suited for any humans, right? Because you need to be, you know, extremely reproducible and reliable, to really thinking about, you know, these higher order problems, right, that we need to solve.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is interesting is, yes, we absolutely need to compress that cycle, but it's also, what if we lived in a world where it was like we just had enough data and confidence going into clinical trials, like say phase two, right, with just a higher
degree,
you know,
of confidence.
Chance. Yeah, degree of confidence that this would get approved, right? So like, how are we heading into clinical trials? And it's like this black box, right? It's almost what was all that R&D, those efforts for, right? If we don't have a high degree of confidence.
Yeah, and I think that's sometimes where folks, and we fall into this quite a lot, drug discovery in its kind of preclinical stage is the easy, sexy stuff to focus on, right? But the downstream stuff is also broken or hurting, right? Like, we've been in CROs and CDMOs, and it's, it feels like walking into, when you talk to management and people on the shop floor there or the lab floor there, It reminds me quite a lot of walking into Ford's engine factory in the Midlands of the UK in 2017. It's like a company with a ton of human capital, really focused on doing the same thing again and again at razor thin margins, with those margins being decimated by error rates, right? Yeah. And when I walk into a CRO, this feels familiar.
And from decades ago in other industries, right?
Yes, and including the business pressures they're under due to their business models. And I think these technologies also help there, right? Okay. Because, you know, whether pharma chooses to pull that process in or continues to outsource it up to the CXOs, having digital data first CXOs is useful for everyone. And we do some of these that work. We're lucky enough to have some incredible customers in that space, and we can see the benefits. And like you say, if your CXO or your CRO is just, instead of returning a PDF, you're just getting access to an S3 bucket mm-hmm. with all the data. And fast forward, the FDA gets the same thing, right? Surely that means A, trials get more robust. Like you say, B, the pressure on the ecosystem producing that data, whether it's pharma or it's supply chains, to improve that data goes up. And therefore, you just have a higher confidence interval that what I'm putting into trial will succeed, because it's just a lot more robustly tested and a lot more transparent to the regulator.
Yeah. And it's like R&D is a very expensive exercise, but clinical trials like
is where it's at.
Be. Yeah. And it's funny. I always tell this example. The other day I was in the metro and I look up and there's an ad, I kid you not, recruiting for a clinical trial. That's how I guess they see millions of folks every day, but right, like how many people are going to know, hey, these are the biomarkers I have to enroll in this trial? It's just, it's hilarious. We're sitting on all this data. We just don't know how to make use of it and create actionable insight. Yeah, I had to laugh. Like that one even shocked me. I feel like I'm pretty well versed with some of the, just how much opportunity there is in this space, but that one really made my head turn a little bit. Okay, I want to focus a little bit. Tell us a little bit about sort of the segments that you currently serve from a customer perspective, and what are those common or early use cases where you're seeing a lot of traction?
Yeah, we could go into what it means for a rapidly growing startup to find product market fit, but that's not the point. But over the last 3 years, we've really refined that process to thinking in horizontals and verticals, like a lot of other startups do, of course. And for us, the verticals in our space reside in the diagnostics. We have a diagnostics vertical in the business. I can talk to it in just a second. We have a kind of CXO vertical in the business. Realistically, we do a lot of work with CROs and CDMOs. And then we have the kind of drug discovery where you have a lot of your listeners will be familiar with our customers in that space, the biotechs and the biopharma company. And then what we found, very pleasantly surprised, is that there are a set of use cases that horizontally cut across those. Or let's say a set of capabilities that horizontally cut across those. A really good example is genomics. That's a technology horizontal, it's a technology platform, which is what genomics is, that cuts across those three verticals really successfully. And what's incredible about genomics is it matters at scale. Yep. And it matters because it's such a verbose technology from a data perspective. And what does that mean in diagnostics? It means things like early cancer detection, right? And we do a lot of work in that space, and we've had a lot of, it's probably our most by revenue successful use case by far. Sure. And then we see less of it in the kind of CRO CDMO space, but we see a lot of it in the biopharma, biotech space, right? For different reasons, right? Okay. That's for more early preclinical research and things like functional genomics, et cetera.
Yeah. And genomics is one of the things where it's just so much data. It's like a human can't possibly wrangle it, right? Like you have to bring in tools to actually make sense of it.
And like between things like pre and post PCR, you cover a wide subsegment of the market, enough to sustain you leveraging your platform for that use case enough where you don't create a subset of your product, right? That's difficult. Like we're a product company and therefore you don't want to create these niche products. But you want to leverage a platform. And that's what I'm incredibly proud of and what the team has done over the last 2 years is like leverage the platform for that horizontal and then commercially find product market fit for it in the segments. Same thing with things like ELISA, right? That has use cases in all three of our verticals, probably the biggest dollar amount in our CXO vertical where we see a ton of it. And then things like cell culture and cell-based assays, same story, right? And those tend to be the three kind of technology or use case horizontals we focus on. And then we've done a lot of work both on our product and our go-to-market motions and our customer success motions to fit those to those three verticals, which is really what's working for us.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All of these you need to do at some scale, creates a ton of data, right? That then you need tools to really help analyze.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to get into this next question I'm super excited about. And now it makes a lot more sense given your architect background. But your product Link actually won a design award, right? So tell us a little bit about that. And also, what is your design approach and process? And how has that really helped to drive customer engagement and interaction, right? I think the challenge that I see in this space always is it's typically scientists, maybe some data scientists using this. No one ever seems to prioritize UI UX, right, for this community of people. And so I think for companies that do, you're going to have a huge advantage early on, right, in terms of adoption and, you know, recurring utilization, right, of the platform and product.
Yeah. So we're really proud of being a product first company. And a big part of that philosophy is the kind of investment in design we've made at Automata, both in the way we build products and literally having a design department in a company like ours who does incredible work, both across hardware and software. I think what's at the heart of both of those, whether it's hardware and software and services these days, to be honest, is the user experience. How do people and scientists use this product? And in hardware, that manifests as a very different design approach than in software, of course, but that is the underlying principle. With hardware, it's about concepts of the modularity, concepts of ease of deployment, concepts of like ease of swap in, swap out, activity, all those kind of things. And that those kind of ideas lie at the heart of our hardware design philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that's manifested as the kind of Link Bench product over the last couple of years. But it's the same approach in software, right? We just have a different set of principles. Literally inside our product design and engineering teams, there's kind of two branches of our design thinking. One is a UX-led, UI-led set of products, which are aimed at the best way to put it is the middle of the road user who wants to leverage this technology, but is not deep enough to really want to explore everything it can do. And therefore, your design teams and your product teams need to be crystal clear that's the kind of user they're focusing on. And have a delicate enough balance of listening to what the user wants, but also having a strong opinion on how this should work to make it easy to use. And then where we really are excited and doubling down is this idea of a developer first experience. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is that increasingly a scientist in 2024 looks like a software programmer. And therefore, and we have customers today where they're doing incredible stuff because we're giving them this idea of a developer-first experience. And if I talk to anyone else in a lot of other industries that have digitized already, some of what we do is, oh my God, what are you talking about? like version control and things like that.
Yeah.
But this is critical, and an ability to connect technology at the API level and the SDK level is super important. And that requires design thinking as well. So we see design as part of the process of customer success at the end of the day through an experience lens rather than a functionality lens. But those two things need to come together. And it's a intricate balance between listening to our internal users, like our pre-sales team is incredible, listening to our actual users, and then listening to what we believe is right long-term. And I think when you have a design culture in your business, you get some incredible results balancing that trifecta.
Yeah. How do you balance? I'm sure there's some tension always, right, between product and engineering, and now you throw design first into the mix. Sometimes it's healthy tension, other times not so much. How do you tend to balance that so that it is product and design, right, centric and first?
I think the challenge on that, and anyone who's building a startup hopefully might be familiar with this, especially if you're in the enterprise space like us, is not that there's friction between PE and D. That's easy to get, right? In my opinion, you just have to build your company like that from day one. I think I've spoke to a lot of people who are like, going from that, from not that to that is hard. But if you have that from the beginning, it's just a matter of daily friction, but not big problems. The challenges between your go-to-market and your product organizations, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you would have heard this a lot, especially if you have a strong sense of product market fit and you're growing really rapidly as a company. because there will be times where a customer is like wanting to pull you in a direction, and that direction is absolutely right for you. And when that moment happens, it's magic. Mm-hmm. And even as someone who runs a company, I've learned to tune my antenna to that moment, because you want to double down on it when it comes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard, and it comes along once in a while, but when it comes, take it. And then there's the moment where something wants to put you in a different direction where, and it doesn't line up to where you think the world needs to go in the long term. And you'd regularly heal this between product-led and sales-led friction, right? And I think that's where Automata has lived in the last 2 years and will likely live for the next 2 or 3 years, just because of how fast we're growing, how strong the demand for this kind of technology is, but how strongly opinionated we are about where this should go. And it's a delicate balance, because sometimes you can come off the path for a year or two sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've been there, done that, right? It's hard, especially early and you're seeing growth and traction, to say no, right?
Yes.
Especially if there's these large flagship customers where you really need that to be your moat and entry point. And it's very hard to say no.
It's usually easy.
I still need to flex that muscle probably.
Same. It's easier to see it in retrospect, I think, which makes it frustrating. So that's more. But luckily, I think what's happening in the space is so exciting that what we think the world should look like is what our customers are also doubling down on. Mm-hmm. And I think we've built this philosophy in the business. Look, to get to that world is going to take time and technology investment. Therefore, you have to underwrite your business in revenue and technology today. And that allows you to build that product future you want. And as long as you manage to walk that path on a monthly, quarterly, annual basis, you'll be fine, right? And it's not easy, but somehow so far we've been really succeeding at doing that.
Yeah. And it sounds like you have a very strong conviction in terms of the company roadmap, but with flexibility built in where an opportunity does present itself to sort of unlock that next market you're all in.
Yeah. I'll give you a live example of that without naming accounts and things like that. But it's like 2-3 years ago, if you sat down, if we were doing this and you're like, oh, what would incredible look like for you in 5 to 10 years? And I'd be talking to you about, I just talked to you about the verticals and the horizontals. Mm-hmm. And okay, fine, the verticals don't change, but there is a world like we just discussed where those horizontals collapse into one lab. And we are seeing that now. We're literally doing that with a couple of customers who are building a multitude of work cells that do a multitude of those use cases across those three horizontals we talked about, stitching them together. So you're switching back and forth between a work cell framework where, hey, I have 12 work cells, that work cell 5 does this, work cell 6 does this, work cell 15 does it, right? And or actually what I have is 3 massive work cells that are interconnected because I have these 15 work cells. I've just like, and this is why we feel we're on the right path, because what we see, okay, that's 5 years out. Suddenly 3 years out, it's a commercial opportunity.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's when the market matches your product conviction. I've been unlucky enough to be in a space where that didn't happen. And a company where that didn't happen, the first version of Automata, and then lucky enough to be in a version of a company where that is happening.
Yeah. You probably learned from that experience, right? That influenced you to think about these technology horizontals. But yeah, it seems like now it's just integrating, right? All these horizontals rather than building, right? A lot of new products in another space. What's the biggest challenge then in building this company?
In building the company?
Yeah.
Building vertically integrated companies is hard, right? You have the capital requirements of a hardware business with the development cycles of a hardware business, as well as needing the pace and deployment ruthlessness of a software business, right? Like software businesses, the best way to build software is deploy it a lot, right? That isn't exactly true for hardware.
Yeah.
And then you're doing it in high trust, high importance environments, right? Like I'm not deploying a B2C app. You're deploying workflow critical, production critical systems in a laboratory for high grade enterprise customers on the cloud. And so that's challenging in its own right. And coming to market in the life sciences is quite difficult, but I would say that has been the biggest challenge. And again, this is where services are super important, because if you just remember at all times that the customer success is the singular metric the company should care about, you figure it out. And for us, what that's meant in the beginning of our journey, and it's massively changed now because it's gotten so much better, is the way I like to think about it is your services teams and functions are a fence around your product, right? And essentially they provide you with a playpen to build your product, mm-hmm. right? And over time, that fence gets more and more porous. Yeah, on day one, it's a concrete barrier. On day 100, it's a white picket fence. And hopefully sometime in the future, there's no fence at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that took us some time to understand. It took us some time to execute. So it's that kind of, and again, running a services department and things like that means headcount. And mm-hmm. so you're navigating this like building hardware, building software, deploying them in real time with a services wrapper. And so it's just like the complex coordination of running a company like that is probably the hardest.
Yeah. I like that analogy for ultimately you're enabling, right, the customer to be independent. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think, yeah, we're still at a time where if you just left it, doesn't matter how well designed, right, if you just left it to their own devices, there would be a higher point rate of failure, right? That's just bad for the company overall. I remember one of the things that really used to keep me up at night is like when we'd be running something and we knew like sample N equals one for the customer, right? Going back yes. to the point about this is absolutely critical, right? It's not that you can iterate and build on. There's a physical, right, sample that's unique, that's involved. And once that gets processed, that's the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. It'll never get that sample back. So it is very unique and high risk, right, in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'll just end with one last question. What advice would you give to fellow entrepreneurs that are looking to innovate in this space?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to start a company here. After moving into the life sciences, I've met more biotech founders than I could have ever imagined. And I think in the biotech space, I have very little advice because I'm not a scientist. But my gut sense tells me like, look, if you have a deep technical scientific insight, throw your weight, your effort, your time, your capital behind that. Right? Make that work because the world needs it. If you're building a technology business in the life sciences like us, that is rare, right? I don't meet many technology founders who have some deep technical insight that needs leveraging, whether it's robotics, right, or software. Therefore, don't build in the dark. You could do that when you're a biotech, and I think that model is understood, and that's why they're very binary outcome businesses. Don't do that in a technology business. If that means do services from day one, run a service before you are a technology business, just to validate that your idea has legs and people have what you want, do that. Just remember that at the end of the day, what you're trying to build is a product company. And therefore, with that in front of you at all times, do the things at the very beginning of the company that don't necessarily mean you're a product, but you're validating that someone wants what you need. And in a lot of ways, that's where Automata got really lucky in 2019 and 2020. It's crazy to talk about COVID as something lucky, but there was just that incredibly rapidly accelerated period mm-hmm. of learning where we did everything and anything to make those labs successful. In our mind, because it was COVID, then it mattered. But in the same time, you were learning on the job massively. And everything that is Link today, our product, modular, easy to deploy, software first, cloud first, microservices architecture, were real-time decisions we made in a year of deploying COVID laboratory. And so if you're lucky, you get that moment. Those come along once in a while. Just double down on discovering that someone needs what your idea is. Don't be precious about your idea. Let it go very quickly. Move on. Get to the next thing. Build that. If you don't have that deep technical insight.
Yeah. That's great advice. And it's very unique from what we've heard from other guests. So thank you for that insight. All right, that we will wrap it. Thank you so much, Mustafa. An absolute pleasure. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.